Okay, hello everyone, and welcome to Tim Topham TV episode 3. What does healthy piano technique mean to me? So today I'm going to be speaking to three guests who are all online, and I thank them very much for being with us. I'll introduce them in just a sec. But today's podcast is all about people's personal experience with piano technique and how it's affected their playing, and indeed how the Taubman technique can fit in with that experience. For those of you who've read my articles before, you'll know that I have a big interest in technique and how it works and the best ways to do it and all those kind of things. So this discussion is going to be exploring how some people have found that experience with technique. So our first guest is Annie Butner-Moore from Queensland. She's a piano and sax performer and teacher. G'day, Annie.
Hello.
And we've also got Leo McFadden, who's a guitar and piano student also in Queensland. G'day, Leo.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for joining us this early morning. And John Bloomfield, all the way from New York, from the Galansky Institute. Good morning, John.
Good day, Sam.
So, look, I think what this podcast will be more of a panel discussion about technique and people's experience with it. So feel free to chime in and give views and that sort of thing. And I've also got a couple of special offers at the end of the podcast too, so feel free to stay tuned for that. So look, I'm going to shoot over to Annie for a really interesting story about the trials and tribulations of technique on two instruments, I think, but particularly in regard to piano. So can you tell us a little bit about your story, Annie?
Okay. Oh God, where does that?
Perhaps you can start with.
I'm how, outdoors. It's me. It's the birds.
How did it come to? You know, how did you come to be involved in this podcast? I guess, and can you sort of take us back to where that journey started?
Okay. Well, I suppose I came to this as I became involved with Therese in the Taubman approach because I was really injured last year, and I have been injured previously, and it was kind of my sort of last resort, you know, at attempting to play the piano. I was ready to chuck in the towel completely.
Yeah, sure.
About midway through last. And I guess it's because I had such a dodgy foundation laid with my just poor teaching I had in the first place.
Right. And what did that lead to? What was the problem?
I grew up in the country and I had limited access to sort of quality teachers, and, you know, I couldn't sight read. I could barely read music to begin with, and, you know, no one ever talked to you about technique until sort of first year uni, and, you know, had a lot of anxiety about my playing at the time, and, you know, I was playing more saxophone, I suppose.
Right. You have some very noisy birds near you.
I'm really sorry. I'm staying in a dorm. I'm staying in a dorm at the minute, and it's so early. I can't really sit in my room, so I had to. I'm terribly sorry.
No, it's okay. Carry on. So you brought up in the country, had these piano lessons, which perhaps didn't give you the best grounding. When did you work that out?
Probably not until about the time I got to uni, I suppose. I just kind of, just kept pottering along, doing what I always did, and had no idea by the time I started my degree just sort of how far behind I was.
Right.
I don't think I was that far behind in comparison to others. I think it's quite... But, you know, I just got through my AMEB exams and passing what they considered as competent, you know, playing your pieces and your scales, and if you had any kind of oral skills or general knowledge or sight reading, that's a bonus.
Yep. Okay, and so...
I suppose...
Go on.
No, it's okay, you go.
Well, I was just going to ask, you know, you went to study at the university level, I think, is that right? And is,
that's right.
Is that where some things started to unravel when it came to piano technique?
Yeah. I had a teacher there who was, you know, obsessive about piano technique, and rightly so, because, you know, I couldn't keep up with the repertoire unless I changed something for the requirements of my degree. You know, it always felt like a bit of a struggle for the first couple of years of my degree. And then when I started to feel like I sort of got a handle of it all, I got a bit ambitious.
Right.
And, pushed myself a bit too far and became injured. And went through various therapies, you know, get myself out of it and just be able to keep playing because that was the requirement. And, nothing really seemed to work. Everything was kind of a preventative measure. Not a preventative measure, sorry, it wasn't preventative at all. It was just, you know, it would kind of get me out of pain. I'd manage to keep playing until I got to a point where I just couldn't play at all, you know, it didn't matter how many physios or whatever I saw.
Yeah, sure. And if we go back just a step, what was the thing that triggered the problems? You said you leaped too far or something. I can't remember your words.
Oh, that's okay. I think it was, you know, just, you know, playing for such long periods of time with so much tension. I think tension is the biggest thing. You know, just doing silly things. It's hard to explain because at the time I was just completely clueless.
Right.
I guess it was just, you know, lots of things like curling and twisting and very un-Taubman-esque stuff.
Well, look, I might throw to John at this stage and just ask, John, is this a common kind of story that you've heard of where people they might get through lower grades and, like we have in Australia and England, and then get to a university level and suddenly go, there's a problem when they push too far?
Well, I think that's exactly right, Tim. People do very often experience problems when they start to do more intensive practicing and more intensive playing. And, you know, very often they reach Taubman-trained teachers as a resource of last resort. They've tried other things. They've tried the medical route. They've tried other technical approaches. They've tried kind of different. So very often people will come to us when they've tried things and they're just not getting help in any other way. And I would say that the intensification of a practice schedule is very often something that kind of pushes them over the edge where, you know, they really feel like they have to seek some kind of help because nothing else is working.
Absolutely. And I guess, and we can talk about this a bit later, I guess that's where we could ask the question, you know, there's a lot in the Taubman approach that we could all use before things get to that point of pain and trouble and
There really is, and maybe we'll be able to shed a little bit of light on that as we continue the discussion. But one of the things I would like to stress at this point is that the Taubman approach is not just curative. It does very well when people have injuries and pain, but it also is preventative. So, you know, it helps you avoid problems before they even set in. And once they set in and become deeply ingrained in the body, it's them, of course, but it's much easier if one doesn't have to deal with them in the first place. So for me, that's one of the strongest points about the Taubman approach is that it can really prevent problems from taking over. And it's just a few simple ideas that you need to know that will keep you out of a whole heap of trouble.
Absolutely. And we'll perhaps get to them a little bit later. I'm interested to go back to Annie and your story. What kind of happened then? So you're at university, you've jumped up in your amount of practice and the level of difficulty of your pieces, and you're in some pain. So what was the pain, firstly? And how did you know there was, like, well, when was the point that you knew there was a problem and what did you do?
I suppose it was really, by the time I hit my fourth and final year of my degree, I had something that sort of resembled tennis elbow, and I kept getting, like, my wrists were swelling and it was just really sore. Within the first 3 weeks of my fourth year, I had to just kind of pull out of my performance unit because I couldn't even turn off a tap or pick up a cup. It was pretty extreme. I was really lucky at that point. I'd bumped into, after trialing all these physios and Alexander Technique and various drugs and potions and whatever, I found Alexander Technique, and that was really helpful.
Right, yeah.
That got me out of it and got me through to the end of my degree. I managed to play essentially pain-free. By my second semester, I got back into it. And then I've just continued taking lessons with a different coach, pretty high-end sort of coach who pushes really hard, has pretty high expectations, makes myself. And, you know, I've been trying to create a bit of a performance profile, and I've been sort of in and out of injury along the way.
Okay.
And I've always known that something's needed to change, but I guess I kind of just kept getting away with it. And I thought, you know, I'll just rest for like a few weeks, a few months here and there, and just keep going. And it got to a point last year where, you know, just couldn't do it anymore. And I had a big performance in Government House Ballroom. I had to play a Beethoven sonata as part of a Beethoven marathon.
Right.
And 3 months before the performance, I realized that there was no way I'd be able to play that, if anything. And that also, you know, I managed to cancel all my other gigs, but who's going to learn an entire Beethoven sonata in 3 months to replace me? No one.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I was really lucky by a passing conversation that I found out about Therese, and I started having Skype lessons with her. And it's amazing just the instant relief I got just over Skype at the piano, which is something, you know, all the physicians tell you, just, you know, if it's playing related, you just need to avoid the...
You just
need to stop. And you're like, okay, well, that's useful for a short-term thing, but what if I want to continue with my career?
Yeah.
I was just so blessed to have found Therese, and she got me out of pain, and I got through that gig pretty well, actually. I'm playing again. It's good.
Oh, fantastic. Well, before we get to what Therese sort of worked with you on, you mentioned that you looked into the Alexander technique as a first point of solution.
Yes, really.
And you said it helped a lot, but it obviously solved the underlying issues.
Yeah, I suppose for me particularly, I've got some interesting kind of motor patterns set up from all of my dancing and stuff as a kid. So I don't move in your conventional way, or what people would consider as conventional. Yeah. So it was really helpful for kind of more general stuff, I suppose, just in the way that I walk and sit. And I mean, my teacher did do some work at the piano with me, which was really helpful, but I suppose at the time I kind of only saw it as a way of just getting me out of pain, a preventative measure to keep me from getting
pain in the future, or sort of thing.
And it's funny going back to it now, having done some Taubman work, it just makes so much more sense and seems more relevant. It's almost like the Taubman approach looks at it from a completely different perspective, but it achieves kind of the same thing.
So I might throw that one to John as well. I assume, John, you're familiar with the Alexander technique. I'm only very, very novice ideas from a few conferences. Are there similarities in approach?
You know, Tim, I don't have direct experience with the Alexander technique. I haven't ever taken lessons, but I do think they're completely complementary. In other words, I don't think there's anything antithetical to the other approach in either one. Mm. I think that what Taubman does is specifically address keyboard-related issues, and Alexander, of course, is more general because that was the whole purpose of that modality.
Mm, sure.
So I think that one can apply Alexander principles to the keyboard, but maybe, you know, there needs to be a refinement with exactly how the hands interact with the keys themselves in order to complete the picture. In any case.
Mm, yeah. And I think I would agree. It's the experience I've had with Alexander's been about position at the keyboard and as you say, Annie, walking and just your body movements, less, more so than the fine motor at the piano and the wrists and things
like that. Yeah, totally.
So can you tell us, Therese, we know she's a wonderful teacher. What did she do in particular? Like, I know you've probably had a number of lessons and done a million things with her, but could you kind of narrow it down to two or three key things that kind of changed perhaps in your mind about your... Or what were the main things that she was able to do with you?
Well, I think, just changing my approach as to how I get from one note to the next was a really big thing via forearm rotation, rather than simply dropping on it or just, you know, making your fingers do all of the work.
Right.
That was really, really useful. And also, because of my saxophone background, I also had very kind of outward tilting sort of rotation. I suppose you always want to have your palms more sort of flat to the floor, but it's amazing of my hand and not sitting so far back but forward. You know, it just makes me feel more stable and grounded, and that in itself just cured oodles of things.
I imagine you probably look back on it and go, well, why didn't I, well, one, why wasn't I told about this earlier, but why didn't I think about it or something? Would they, those sorts have come to mind?
Man, why didn't I learn this when I was four?
Yeah. I wonder, John, is this a kind of common thing that you hear as well from students going, why are you teaching these things the right way from the beginning?
You know, absolutely, Tim, I hear it all the time. And it's something that I've wondered myself. I mean, when I first went to Mrs. Taubman, one of the things that really hooked me right in the beginning was the idea that, you know, stretching the fingers wouldn't make them work well, or no amount of stretching, no amount of practicing with a stretched hand was going to make it any easier. When she explained that and made me experience it, I thought, you know, where have I been all of these years? I was almost at the point of having a master's degree. Told me that, and it made so much sense. And, you know, I didn't have to have verification from the outside world. My own body was giving me the picture, and I couldn't imagine why that information wasn't more widespread. So yes, it is. It's very common to hear, you know, why haven't I heard this before?
Well, hopefully towards the end we can give some teachers who are listening some key sort of ideas about how they can go from here about learning more about it. But I'm interested, did you actually have an issue with pain or anything like that? Is that your Dorothy?
Yes, you know, I would say that I wasn't calling it pain at the time, but I was very, very tight. Mm. And, you know, it affected speed, accuracy, sound, interpretation. It affected everything. And so, you know, very often I would play and I would get through, you know, the performance, but my arms would just feel absolutely leaden by the end. And so I would say that, you know, it was, if it wasn't injury, it was on the road to injury.
Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Well, Annie, thank you for that. We may well come back to you. Very patient there. How are you going, Leo?
I'm well, thank you, Tim.
I would love to hear a little bit of your, that same kind of story about how you've come to be on this podcast. You know, if you can take us right back to the beginning, where it started in your kind of journey about with piano technique.
Okay, so basically I was doing a master's degree in Boston, Massachusetts, and I got interested. I'm a guitarist by trade. I was in guitar. Right. Then I subsequently started taking theory lessons, and the teacher I took lessons from was a student of Edna Galansky.
Right.
And for those listeners who don't know, she's like the heir, I suppose, to Dorothy Taubman. And this person was very anxious that I study with a Taubman teacher. She said, you need to study piano, you know, if you want to continue with this theory stuff, you should study piano. So I'd had some lessons as a child, but never really got beyond the very kind of elementary levels of piano playing. And on Queensland, I sought out a Taubman teacher. Actually, my theory teacher took it upon herself. She met Therese at a conference in Princeton and said, I found you a teacher. You've got to go to this person. but I contacted Therese and she was too busy. She had a PhD to finish, and which is now finished. And yeah. She was just like up to her eyeballs in it. And she said, look, I'd love to teach you, but I just can't at the moment.
It's not a bad excuse, I guess. I've just got to finish my PhD.
Yeah. And if you book that came about as a result of that PhD, you'd be even more forgiving of her for taking that.
That's terrific. Yeah. That book.
That's
so
right.
just to clarify where we're up to. So you hadn't had any pain issues associated with your piano because you'd only had kind of reasonably elementary instruction, decided from your theory teacher's suggestion to go back and learn piano because that's so good for following your theory work. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I was like reducing scores and couldn't do it at all. And she's like, you need to get piano lessons because, as you guys know, it's such a great tool for harmony. And yeah, so I started doing these Tarvin lessons, and I was sort of, I had had experiences with my guitar training where it had affirmed me in the view that you should meticulously sort of get technique down first. I remember I switched to a sort of a very good classical guitar teacher when I was about 14 years old. And before that, I had mainly a folk. And he said, oh, look, there's, you know, I hadn't experienced it yet because I hadn't done sufficient amounts of practice to kind of bring up pain. But he was like, you've got to get this in order and this, this, and this. And he was very meticulous. And so I think at that early age, it sort of instilled in me that ethic that you should sort of work at things and take it very methodically and get things in place before there was a problem. So when I came to Therese, I was just like willing to go back to, even though I could play, I was willing to sort of go and just play like very slow, like crotchet equals 40 scales for 6 months or something, and that's all we did, and just worked in all these things. And then subsequently, in about the space of I think 3 or 4 months, I was surprised when I looked back at the time frame, I was able to do the grade 8 examination. So Tarvin can be very effective in sort of getting results fast if the initial stages.
Mm. That's a really, really interesting story. And you said, and I have to agree, obviously, getting that technique right from the start is fantastic. And so often pianists miss that. So you were very lucky in that regard, I guess. But you said, you know, you worked with a Tarvin teacher, I think, before Therese. Is that right?
Well, my theory teacher was a had trained with Edna Galansky, so she was Tarvin trained, and she sort of gave me some Tarvin principles to go on with, but she was always saying you need to get some instruction. And indeed, when Therese teached me, she recommended me to a student of hers, but the lessons were sporadic because that person was in the process of moving. So although I had some good, you know, cursory instruction, it was just that, it was very cursory, and I didn't get to actually studying piano or Tarvin or anything until I got to Therese. So.
Right. Okay. That's, yeah, a really interesting story. And I'm interested to compare that with Annie. It sounds like, Annie, you would have been at a point in your playing where you couldn't go back to playing scales at crotchet equals 40 for...
Tell
me about it.
I went and flew to Brisbane and spent every day for about 2 weeks having a lesson with Therese, just relearning how to get from one note to the next.
Right.
It was intense, but I'm so glad that I did it. Because, yeah, as you were mentioning before, it's, you know, it's so important to have these foundations kind of there. And even though I have been playing advanced repertoire for quite some time now, you know, it's not going to work unless you have those foundations. So I'm more than willing to go back.
And that made all the difference, obviously.
Totally.
Yeah. John, I'm interested in your opinion on this. When people come who might have been playing for some time, is it always necessary for the approach to be, we've really got to get back to absolute basics, single notes, double notes, that sort of thing? Or can sometimes you just correct simple things without going back to the start sort of thing?
Yes, you know, it's a very, very good question, Tim. And sometimes you can make wonderful advances with very, very little instruction. I would say that you never, as a teacher, want to tamper with something that isn't broken. So, you know, if something is working well, you simply leave it alone. And, you know, you address problems where you find them. So the idea that, you know, you have to go back and just stand on one finger, one note for a long time, it's not completely true. I would say that, you know, people come, of course, with an enormous variety of problems and an enormous variety of issues, some very quickly, and others of which take much more time to kind of sort through and work out. So, you know, I always am interested in taking a person where he or she is, rather than kind of, you know, making a cookie cutter production out of them where, you know, they all have to do the same thing. And because problems are so different, you know, people hear explanations very differently sometimes. So the way that I would explain something to one person could be vastly different from the way that I would explain it to another person, just depending on what their perspective was. We're always going through the lens of our past experience. And, you know, as a result, the problems that people come with are just quite varied. So I don't think there's, I mean, there is one efficient way to use the body, which is what Taubman was exploring, but there's not one avenue for people to take as they, you know, encounter pianistic problems. And I should say, really, as they encounter kind of solutions for pianistic problems.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's probably, it goes for all teaching, doesn't it? Where, you know,
I think so.
And how we actually connect with every individual student, regardless of what we're talking about, that makes all the difference.
Yes, I certainly agree.
So, Leo, you mentioned that you got to, you mentioned something about grade eight. Did you, how long did it take you to go from when you picked up the first kind of your first lessons to getting to that grade eight finish? It sounds like it might have been quite quick.
I think it was about 9 months.
Nine months?
Yeah, I think about 6 months of kind of training. Like, I think I'd done sort of the intermediate grades as a kid, but seriously, I mean, Therese said to me once, I said, I think I did grade five once as a kid, and she goes, yeah, you weren't out grade five when you came to me. Because, like, I think I got a pass, like a C in grade five when I was about 14 years old. So I think, and I hadn't played piano since, and I think it was sort of like one of those things, like my sister used to play excerpts of Phantom of the Opera, and every year it would get less, like she'd start get up to the third bar, and then when she was in her 20s she'd get to the second bar. It was a little bit like that. But yeah, it was funny. One thing I'd love to add though, apropos to what John was talking about, is that I think that Taubman's a lot more than retraining sort of for injuries, because it's a whole different way about thinking about music intellectually at the piano, not just physically at the piano. So I'm really fascinated by the stuff that, and how kind of uniform the approach is on, or when I have a lesson with Therese, it's this same sort of sense of organization. So they'll see like an octave, like a pattern that repeats, but they'll group it, and it won't be grouped metrically. It will be grouped in a way that makes it very, very easy to think about, and very easy for the hand to sort of move in between the intervals. And it comes back to a physical thing. It comes back to like not stretching, but it helps your mind approach it in a different way. And I think that's why I was able to progress fast, because I had this that one might sort of stumble upon after years of playing if they were just left to their own devices. I had someone sort of illuminating this express lane for me, which was great.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I've seen, I might have seen the same kind of, I think you're talking about that, the thinking about the movement being really important. I remember a video I think I watched of the kind of example being, you know, if you had a whole run of tenths or something like that. So let's say they go, it goes C, and then E to the next G above or something like that. And rather than thinking about the interval of the tenth, you just think about the octave downwards or something like that. Is that the kind of idea? Like just changing mindset about the patterns that you see?
Well, yes, they definitely, I mean, John's here. He should be talking about this rather than I, because he's far more qualified to do it. But I was more speaking, I mean, rather than a sort of a fixed interval progression where you've got like a series of tenths, if you had a figure such as a B, G, and then you had E, E in octaves, so you had B, G in the middle of the two E octaves, a Taubman perspective of how to organize that might be quite different as to where that group started from. I'll hand it over to John because he's far better than I to explain it.
I think you're doing a great job, Leo. And, you know, I would just echo the idea that the thinking is so, so important. And I think it's not an uncommon idea in piano circles to think the way we think is actually part of how we develop technique. And it's certainly true with Taubman work as well. And just to further maybe elucidate something that you said about organization, the way we learn best is through patterns. And that's not only in music, it's in anything that we learn. If something seems chaotic and random to us, it's very hard to internalize. But if we can see a series of patterns or we can sense an organization in what we're trying to learn, then it's much easier to internalize. Think about learning a foreign language or learning how to drive a car. Any task that you learn, if there's an organization that underlies that task, it's going to be much easier to internalize the information. And part of learning how to approach the keyboard is exactly what you said, Leo, is learning how to organize the music in a way that makes sense, not only for the brain, but also for the body. So, you know, things, I mean, in any piece of music you look at, there's going to be some kind of organizing factor that you can use to help yourself understand it from the intellectual standpoint, understand it from the musical standpoint, and then understand it also from standpoint so that you can internalize it faster. And Leo, I think maybe you're a quick study. Not everyone would get to grade 8 with the speed that you did, but I think that idea that you said of learning how to see patterns and learning how to organize for yourself must have been a great help.
Yeah, it certainly was. And it was also a great help to study with a teacher who, I think it's like that idea of the incoming tide floats all boats all ships, because I had this this great teacher who was willing to work with me in a Taubman-esque problem solving sleuth like manner to uncover any mental roadblocks which existed. So there were many, because we would discover that because I hadn't been trained on the keyboard and it wasn't natural for me, certain things I could do that the pianist would find challenging, I could do quite easily. But then there were other things that even and kind of an elementary or intermediate level would be able to do quite effortlessly was so hard for me. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that the Taubman approach is never like, okay, we'll just go away and work at that. It's always like, okay, there's if you take a Taubman workshop, there's often a sort of a segment which is called intractable problem, let's find a solution. And that is very much sums up the Taubman mentality, I think, in that you have these people who are not willing to accept that something should be very, very difficult. It's like, well, why is that difficult? Let's uncover why that's difficult. Let's break it down into manageable segments, and then let's put that together.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that's right. And we have Dorothy Taubman to thank for that, because she was very democratically minded, and she thought that anyone who wanted to play should be able to play. I mean, of course, you know, people have different aptitudes and different sensitivities, and there will be some people always who, you know, manage to play better than others. But she felt that everyone should be able to play to the best of their ability. And so she gave her students the idea that every problem has a solution and that it's a teacher's job to give that solution to the student. So I think, you know, it would be very tempting to say in many cases, well, this person just isn't very talented, they're not going to get it. But she would keep on looking until she found a solution for anyone that was in her studio. And that was a real gift to all of her teachers, because that kind of a model, I think, is carried through to well-trained Taubman teachers, and we all understand that it's our job to find a solution when someone is struggling.
Mm. In any aspect of their education, really, isn't it? It's almost easy, or it can be easy. You know, you've had a long day, or you're getting to the end of a term, or something like that, and you're like, you know, just keep practicing that; it'll get better. Or you know, it's too easy, isn't it? But I have seen in those videos that it's so clear that the Dorothy's approach was always just keep going and going and going and say things a different way, keep approaching it from a different angle, and then bang, you'll eventually get it.
Right. I think that's exactly right and well expressed.
Mm. Well, look, John, I'm interested. Actually, sorry, before I go to you again, Leo and Annie, I'm interested. Is there any other things that come up as part of your personal stories that you might like to mention before we go on and just talk about some things that teachers can potentially put into action in their studios? Doesn't necessarily have to, but I thought I'll just throw it back to you. Anything from you, Annie, at this stage? You might think of things towards the end, which is fine.
Yeah, I think I've already picked up in my very short period that I have been working with the Taubman approach. My teaching has completely transformed. Just basic things like getting your seating height right, and just working with rotation. I think that they're some of the sort of key things that but it's one of those experiential things. I'd encourage anyone, if they don't understand about this, go and get some lessons in the Taubman approach. You need to experience this to be able to teach it, obviously. But yeah, I think it's great.
Okay, and I'll come back to that issue of rotation and how to find more information in just a second. Leo, did you want to say anything else at this stage?
Yeah, just say apropos what you had said about, like, at the end of a long teaching day, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I found that when I teach a lot of guitar, and I have taught extreme amounts of guitar, 6 days a week sort of thing, and I found that when I started applying Taubman principles, and this correlates with something Therese told me, she said, I used to hate teaching until I discovered the Taubman method. And I think that's, I think a lot of teachers wouldn't admit that, but there are a lot of disgruntled music teachers out there. And I think the reason is that they're not engaged with the process of teaching. It's quite sort of intellectually numbing, because you're teaching something that you know how to play, and why can't this student get it? As soon as you reverse turn the tables on that, and it becomes more a question of the teaching is what the challenge is. It's not like I can already play this piece, so why can't this student play this? It should be easy. Once the question becomes why is this student finding this difficult, and how can I make this easy for this student, teaching becomes a whole new and very engaging pursuit. And I have no sort of apathy toward teaching, even on my kind of tiredest days where I've had a big gig the night before, and I still really enjoy, and I've got a particularly challenging student, I still enjoy the process of trying to sort of uncover the solutions. So I think Taubman also presents a lot of interesting options there.
Yeah, Leo, I think that is one of the best little soliloquies I've heard in some time. That was awesome. It actually sums up a lot of what I do with my blogging and why I do it. That whole idea of reversing the angle and looking at how can I make my teaching as good as I possibly can? How can I engage this student? How can I help them understand? You've hit the nail on the head, in my opinion. Well, nicely said. Now, John, we've obviously been talking a lot about the impact of technique on students. So we've got mainly piano teachers listening to this, and I'm wondering if you had just a top 3 or 5 recommendations. It could be a physical thing teachers could do with their students, or a mindset change, anything like that, that teachers can implement straight away in their studios in their next lessons, or could at least try or think about in their next few lessons.
Absolutely, Tim. And of course, if you're going to look at the Taubman approach in depth, then there's a lot of information there. But I think there are a few things, if people are interested, that they can begin to do that will make a huge difference. First of all, is something that Annie touched on, and that is the seat height. If you're not sitting at the right height, then you can't possibly interact with the instrument in a way that's going to be efficient. So I would say for every student to find the seat height that allows the arm to balance over the fingertips. And another way to say that is the place, you want to be sitting in a place where the forearm is parallel to the plane of the floor. If the chair doesn't, if the bench doesn't adjust, then you can build it up with, you know, books or pillows or, you know, something that will give some more height. If the bench is too high, which is not usually the case, then you can find another chair. So even when the bench seems, you know, unyielding, there are still ways to manage the seat height. I would say that that would be the very, very first thing, and it's something that every person can do. The next thing that
Sorry, John, just on that. Do you have a preference for where students on the bench, towards the front, towards the back, that sort of thing?
Or is I would think that the place people should sit most easily is on the front half of the bench. I think many people think this, though. This isn't something that's unique to the Taubman world at all. But your torso simply has more mobility if you're on the front half of the bench rather than have your thighs, you know, so far back on the bench.
Sure. Yep. Great. Okay. So seat height, number one, and
then I would say the next
forearms straight.
Yes. The next most important thing would be to an unbroken connection between the arm and the hand. In other words, you want to have the feeling that the arm-hand connection is exactly the same as it is when the arm is hanging down by the side doing nothing. So basically what it means is that the wrist is a fairly flat kind of connection, that, you know, it's not dipped like this, which is, of course, very common when we approach the instrument. The whole idea is that you want to have the arm support the finger as it goes into the keys. And if this condition, that is the connection between the arm and the hand, isn't as it occurs in the body naturally, then the arm won't support to the fingers as they play.
Fantastic. Great tips.
Then I would just like to add three other small points, which will help a lot, even if people don't understand why at the moment. But it's actually quite easy. If you open your hand to the point where you feel the fingers stretch and try to move them up and down, and then compare that to the hand in a position where the fingers are not stretching at all, you'll find that the fingers move much more easily when they're not stretched.
Yep.
So I would say that you simply want to organize the music, organize the choreography so that you don't stretch fingers, because they'll never move as well in a stretched position as they do when they're in their natural position. Then the same would go for curling the fingers, that is pulling in the fingers at the nail joint, and for twisting the hand away from the arm. So I would say that the things to watch are the stretching, the curling, and the twisting. That avoids so many problems before they ever set in.
Sure. Yeah. And so the just to clarify, the would you perhaps have a student actually try that?
Absolutely.
That practice. So put fingers in the air and try and wiggle them. Do that exercise. Yeah.
That constantly when I'm working with people, just so that they can convince themselves. I mean, people shouldn't take what I say just because I say it. I mean, you know, you should have the feeling inside that something is right based on your own experience of it.
I must say, one of the issues I have with students is when they have first finger joints that seem to be very weak and bend backwards. I'll try and get them to play more on the tips of their fingers, but what will end up happening is they'll go too far and they'll play almost on their fingernails in a two-curl position. So have you got... And I know this is a common issue, this idea of the first weak first joints. Have you got any tips of how to approach that? Or perhaps is it a problem? Is it not a problem?
It is a problem. And one of the things that makes it a problem is people think they have no control over it. So one of the things I try to help people understand if this is an issue is that they do have control over how they manage the interaction with the key. So, for example, there could be a collapse in that first joint, or there could be a curling in that nail joint, or there could be, you know, the feeling that there's a stability just based on the natural kind of posture of the finger. And very often I'll get people to experience all three possibilities. What's it like to have that collapse? What's it like to have it curl? What's it like to have it just stand straight? And if people get the idea that they can actually control the way that their bodies interact with the instrument, they think that there's a solution. It's only when people think there's no control that they feel hopeless about it.
Sure.
The teacher feels hopeless. Maybe I should say it that way. It's often not an overnight fix. And particularly with students that are quite young, the soft tissue is quite soft. You know, it may be more of an issue. It wouldn't be my number one priority, but you are right that it's a problem.
I'll put a link in the show notes to, I saw the Teach Piano Today guys had a little, they'd made a small little, it's kind of like a little mini drum with a balloon on the top of it, which allowed students to get used to that feeling. It's hard to describe, but I'll put a link to it in the show notes. It looks like quite an interesting little practice tool. But I do find that I think students find it difficult to focus on because they can instantly get nice big loud sounds if they let their weak joints collapse, and it's very hard to train them out of it. No, that's great. And sorry, I just wanted to pick up on your fifth point. You mentioned twisting. What was that? Could you just clarify that?
Yes. I don't know whether the viewers can see my hand or not, but if you take a look at the natural connection between the arm and the hand, you'll see that there's a relatively straight connection. By twisting, I mean pulling the hand to the extreme range of motion away from the arm. It looks like this, if you can see,
I'm not sure we've got visual, that's all.
The doctors call that ulnar deviation, if that helps.
All right, so if I put my hand straight in front of me and my hand aligns with my arm and then move it either to the right or the left without going up or down, is that the kind of movement you're talking about?
That's exactly right, Tim.
So you want to try and avoid that?
Yes, exactly. And it's simply because the fingers don't move as well and when the hand is twisted as they do when the hand is straight.
Yeah. No, that does make sense. Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you so much, John. That's great. We're going to start wrapping up now. It's been a really fantastic discussion, but I know one of the things that people are going to be asking for is how they can find out more, because I've found this fascinating as well. So the first thing I just wanted to mention, John, the Galansky 12th Annual Summer Symposium is coming up in July at Princeton University.
Yes.
And that's July 11 to 19. Can you tell us just very briefly the kind of things that teachers would get out of that or what they would expect from it?
Oh, Tim, it's a wonderful session and very intensive. We have lectures, master classes, presentations, technique clinics, pedagogy clinics, concerts. It's just a wide, wide variety of things that are of interest to pianists and piano teachers. So there's a very full menu, and we try to serve everyone's needs.
It sounds amazing. And how many teachers would go to that normally?
I would say that we have probably 120 participants as a rule, and they all get four half-hour private lessons during the course of the symposium.
Ah, fantastic. Taubman specialist, I assume.
With the Taubman specialist, exactly.
That's great. Okay. And look, I can mention that I'll leave a link to the symposium registration in the show notes, and you can get $50 off until the end of April.
Yes.
If you sign up, in the next little while. So I'll pop a link to that on the show notes. And I just wanted to also mention that the Galansky Institute has started streaming instructional videos on your website, which is, I think, really, really exciting. So I'm assuming they're recordings of masterclasses, John, are they? Or teaching?
Yes,
or are they lectures?
They're absolutely, lectures and masterclasses.
Fantastic. So we've got a great offer. The Galansky Institute has made a special offer for listeners of the podcast that they can get a month free of this streaming by going to the galanskyinstitute.org/streaming. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's $9.95 per month for access after that, but you'll get the first month free. You'll need to put in your credit card info to get through the system, but once you're in there, if for whatever reason you choose not to continue, you'll be able to pull out before the end of that first month. But I think it's a really great offer. The promo code is TOPHAM with a capital T, TOPHAM. I'll put that in the link as well. And anyone that subscribes gets free digital access to International Piano Magazine. So fantastic offer from those guys. And I'll thank you very much, John, on behalf of the Galansky Institute for that. It's great.
I hope a lot of listeners take advantage of it, Tim.
I've been exploring myself, and it's just such a fantastic resource, particularly for those of us who are in Australia and can't get away to the symposium. For us, it's such a great way of connecting. But I guess there's one other opportunity for teachers, and that's to connect with a Taubman teacher for one-on-one lessons. Now, can this be done via Skype with teachers?
Yes, it can be. I would say that in-person lessons are always best, but, Skype works surprisingly well, and particularly if there's, common vocabulary and common kind of grounding. say that it's more difficult, you know, to do Skype from the very beginning, but sometimes it's the only choice. And I think Annie probably is a good example of someone who had success with that. So we do encourage Skype lessons for people who are interested. Mm-hmm. And all of the teachers' email information is on the website so that, you know, people can connect easily with whomever they would like.
Mm. I'll put a link to the Golansky list. I think I've got that from you, John. So I'll pop that on the show notes. And I'll also leave Therese Milanovic's details. She's a teacher in Brisbane. If you're a local in Queensland, you can have personal lessons with, I think, Australia's only fully qualified Taubman teacher at the moment. Is that right, John? Perhaps you're not
it
sure.
is. And yeah. We have a couple of other people in our certification program. But Therese is someone that I would call an expert. And I think anyone who has the slightest bit of curiosity would do well to be in touch with her. So please, to all of your listeners, that would encourage that.
Mm. And I have got personal experience. I had a lesson with Therese when I was having some issues preparing for my diploma. And so I can say she solved my issue in one lesson, which was great. So thank you, Therese, when you have a listen. So look, I think we will wrap it up there. It's been so good talking to you all. Thank you, Annie, firstly. It sounds like the birds have quietened down now.
Oh, I hope.
Thank you, Leo, as well, for your input.
Thank you, Tim. Very very pleased to be part of it.
That's great. Well, look, hopefully we can perhaps even catch up with you all again down the track and see how things have progressed. And John, of course, thank you for being able to connect with us. Good luck with the symposium. Hope that goes well.
Thank you. My complete pleasure. I have a very warm spot in my heart for Australia, and it's always a pleasure to be a part of a discussion there.
Awesome. Thank you very much, John. So, look, I'll wrap it up there. I just wanted to mention episode 4 of the podcast. I'm going to be speaking to Colin Thompson, who is the developer of a brand new online course in sight reading. Now, this is actually quite revolutionary. I'm very excited to talk with him. So that'll be in a couple of weeks' time. So make sure you listen in. And thanks to all our guests. I look forward to speaking with you again in a couple of weeks.